Facebook session number 13280, Reel 2.
Doug Evans, Reel 2.
Right, Mr. Thomas James, a native of Letterston in Pembrokeshire, a small village some 6 miles from my home village of Goodick. As a very young man, after he'd learned his trade in building, he went first of all to London, and I think he thought there were opportunities over the other side of the Atlantic. He duly went across, and he had a most colourful story to tell of his activities, I must say, jumping trains from east to west, that sort of thing, finding work where he could. He was certainly very enterprising, and he finally settled in Atlanta, and he married a lovely lady from Tennessee. So he met me this day, USO, saw my address as being Goodick, Pembrokeshire, and we had a long chat, and he took me to his home. Thereafter, I saw him fairly frequently, as often as I could at any rate, as well as Mr. and Mrs. Trammell Scott during my stay in each of these stations. And on my way home from Atlanta, from Valdosta, in December 1942, Mr. Thomas James was on the platform at Atlanta to meet the train and to bid me farewell. Happily, we were to see him two or three times after that, twice at home in Pembrokeshire after the war, where he came and visited my parents, and we also saw him and his wife, Mary Lou, in Atlanta, Dorothy and I, my wife and I. But, sorry to say, neither of them are any longer with us. Great pity, as they were lovely people, and I've very, very fond memories of both of them.
So you returned to the UK in the winter of 42-43 with your wings?
Yes. Sorry.
Did you run into the enemy on your way back across the Atlantic?
No, we were aboard a, unlike going over, we were not in convoy, and we were on board a Royal Mail Lines liner, the name of which, strangely enough, I cannot remember. Beautiful ship of her day, very fast, and whereas it took us 11 days or more to get across east to west, in February, I think it was, here we crossed in about 5 to 6 days on the return to Gourock.
What was your first operational squadron?
The first operational squadron, after all the training procedures and the operational training and the heavy conversion unit training, my first operational squadron was number 10 bomber squadron at RAF Melbourne, Yorkshire. They operated Halifax bombers in Europe, and at that time were equipped with Halifax 2 aircraft, each with four Rolls-Royce Merlin engines. And the Mark III came in later with four Bristol Hercules engines. I joined the squadron on 26th of August 1943 and remained with them until the 26th of May 1944.
Was there much difference between the two marks of Halifax?
Oh, great deal of difference, yes. The Bristol Hercules engines made a big difference to the performance of the Halifax. And whereas in these raids that we were involved in over Europe, over Germany and elsewhere, At the commencement of my tour, the Stirlings were still flying. Well, the Stirling chaps had a tough time because they were unable to make the heights that we were able to make, and we were fairly restricted in Halifax too. But they were below us, and if we were at 14,000 or 15,000 thereabouts, perhaps the Stirling would be 2,000 or 3,000 lower at that stage. The Stirlings were taken off the operational, as far as I remember, sometime during the earlier part of my tour, which left us at the bottom of the pile, as it were. The Lancasters are well and truly above. When the Halifax 3 came in, we had a much better aeroplane, lots more power, lots more. We could climb to better heights. We had more manoeuvrability, more power available at height when things became difficult to handle the aeroplane, that sort of thing. So, yes, it was a much better aeroplane, really.
How had you crewed up, personally?
Well, at my OTU, I was at 10 OTU at Abingdon, and it's there that I found my navigator, Paddy Hamilton, my radio officer, Nick Nicholson, and the bomb aimer, Jim Manson, and tail gunner, Harry Hull. So it was a very hit and miss affair. You were all together. This was the occasion when you were going to crew up, and you simply looked around, and others did the same, and you suddenly found that, yes, you had a full complement. So to start with, we had pilot, navigator, and tail gunner, and flight engineer. I think the flight engineer came at OTU. We were on Whitley's at OTU.
Were they all British, your crew?
No. Yes, apart from the bomb aimer. My bomb aimer was Canadian. Jim Manson was Canadian. So we fully crewed up, of course, at the con unit at Rickall. Heavy HCU, heavy conversion unit, at Rickall in Yorkshire. Rickall is about 9 or 10 miles south-southeast of York, I think, about that distance. And so I was British, my Welsh certainly, and we had a mixture of British, you see, because I was Welsh. Paddy Hamilton was my navigator. So he was the Irish element. At that stage, the flight engineer, Jock Henry, so he was the Scotsman among us. We had Jim Manson, the Canadian. That's four. Then we had three English people, two English gunners, Harry Hull and Les Duncan, and Nick Nicholas, our wireless operator. We had an emblem on our aeroplane at 10 Squadron. And the emblem was that of crossed leeks. And inside the segments, we had the thistle, the shamrock, and the maple leaf, and the English rose. So that was our emblem on the side of F for Freddy during most of our tour, reflecting the cosmopolitan nature of our crew makeup.
Did you personalise the aircraft in any other way, like some people put a number of operations on and that type of thing?
Yes, those were put on by the ground crew, I think. We didn't ourselves do that. But it was personalised by them. They were wonderful people, tremendously interested, tremendously keen, tremendously proud. And that side of it was left to them.
What was the Halifax like to fly in from the point of view of comfort and space and so on?
Well, I think we were reasonably well off in the Halifax. The pilot's seat was fairly high on the left-hand side. The second pilot, now for operational purposes, the bomb aimer, would come to occupy the second pilot seat for takeoff and for landing. And we had quite a good seat which swung up across the space leading down to the front of the aeroplane from the pilot's compartment. And for the short time that he was required to sit in that area to assist the pilot to taking off and landing, he had really quite a comfortable seat. I think, from what I understand, in other aeroplanes, not quite so good. Below us in the Halifax was the wireless operator, fairly restricted area, but he had room to operate his LEM 54-55 equipment. Forward of him, very adjacent to escape hatch, by the way, was the navigator at his table, and forward to him would be the bomb aimer. Big thing about the Halifax was that it seemed to me that in times of real trouble, emergency exits were fairly well to hand if it became necessary to abandon the aeroplane. And that, I think, was a big, very important feature of the Handley Page Halifax.
Do you remember your first operation?
Yes, I do. I remember my first operation very well. A fellow countryman of mine, a Welshman, by the name of John Jenkins, known as Taffy Jenkins, he was well established on the squadron and had already made quite a name for himself. He had in fact achieved quite a lot through some very difficult flights prior to this, so he was well known, already awarded a DFC. I was allocated to Taff Jenkins for my supernumerary flights. The first one of which I did on September the 5th of 1943 to Mannheim, and the second of which was the next day, September the 6th, to Munich. The first flight took 7 hours 50, that's to Mannheim, and to Munich it took us 9 hours. That's the kind of time scale involved in flying around Europe in those days, places which these days seem so much nearer.
How frightening was your first raid?
Well, I don't think I found it frightening. It was just that it was interesting, and one was hoping to learn what one could, not only to do the job as best you could when the time came to start doing it yourself with your crew, but also in order to protect yourself and your crew and to know as much as you could, learn as much as you could about how to protect yourselves as well as how to do the job.
What were the main things that you did to protect the crew?
Well, I think it's a matter of engendering trust between each other as a crew, and we were very well suited, it seems to me, to each other. We were good friends. We'd worked together at OTU. We'd worked together at Con Unit. We'd shaken down our procedures in relation to our individual personalities and attitudes. So that's the first thing. We seemed to be pretty well in tune, I think. I remember old Taff Jenkins always telling me, boy, he said, you just keep weaving. Don't ever stay straight and level. Now you keep weaving. Bearing in mind what that effect that has, so far as the navigators are concerned, especially when you have winds which are on your beam. But he said it is a safe practice when you're over the other side. And I have to say that I took his advice. And once over the other side, I maintained a steady weave in all cases, all through my time on the squadron. Now, it didn't always please the navigator because it was difficult for him. Navigation was most awkward, complicated, uncertain practice in those days. Dead reckoning, of course, was the main navigational practice. We had G, which gave us fixes, perhaps to halfway across the North Sea, a little bit beyond maybe. I think we were lucky, though, in so far as that a little later on we became an H2S equipped squadron. And apart from the fact that I had an absolutely marvellous navigator, Paddy Hamilton, he was brilliant. One of these chaps with a highly mathematical mind, and it was so easy for him to do it and do it well. And he had all the confidence in the world, and he was always right. It was nice to think that he also had H2S to help him and to help me help him when I used to keep this business of weaving going. Because we did have difficult times, and mind you, we'd liaise with each other, of course. And if things were difficult navigationally, we would try and sort things out and carry on when we got things sorted out. But he was absolutely wonderful, brilliant.
So did the weaving just involve moving from side to side?
Yes.
Or changing
a slightly
altitude as well?
Oh, no. Maintain your altitude, but a slight weave, port and starboard. I do remember in later years when I was flying with BEA, flying a lot in Germany, in fact, someone told me, one of my colleagues, I can't remember who it was, that in talking to German pilots, German pilots said, well, if we saw aeroplanes weaving about, we didn't bother with them because we'd always look for the one that was straight and level. It was an easier target. And so what old Taft told me on September the 5th, 1943, seems to have borne true, in fact.
Now, can you take me through your raids to the ones that stick out in your memory as being particularly notable for incident?
Yes, I'm happy to say, to begin with, that I don't consider that I had a great deal of incident. And I considered myself at the time, and I consider myself now, to have been very fortunate to have come through the 32 flights that I did with 10 Squadron at that time. Largely due to an excellent crew in every respect, every one of them. And I have wonderful memories of each of them. So we come to my third one, which was to Hanover on the 22nd of September 1943. As far as I know, that was incident-free. And then we came to my next one, which was number four, again to Hanover. We had to divert to a place in Norfolk called Hethel. That was because of fog in Yorkshire. Now, we had a device on board which warned you about balloon wires. And I distinctly recall that this device sounded as we were somewhere in the vicinity of Norwich. But it all ended happily, and we landed at Hethel in good order after 6 hours 20 in the air, and we returned to Melbourne the next day. On the 3rd of October 43, I went to Kassel, 7 hours 10 minutes. Now, one of these, can't remember which of these, it's not recorded in my book, but I do very well remember, we lost an engine somewhere between the target Mannheim and the coast, and we got very tied up over the islands off the coast of Holland, because we were on three engines, flying more slowly, and the aeroplane less manoeuvrable, and we were at a medium height, and the flak was predicted flak as distinct from unpredicted flak, meaning it was fairly accurate, They didn't actually hit us, but we were very, very close, and it was difficult to handle the aeroplane, but we got through it okay, got ourselves back, and that was on three engines fairly early on. Not a great problem, really, landing on three engines. It was more the problem of dealing with the flak as we crossed that particular piece of coastline. On to Frankfurt on the 4th. Now, I think that must be the one that I returned early from, and that was because old Paddy Hamilton, my navigator, we were on the climb. It was October, we were in daylight, so we must have taken off fairly early on. And we were in the climb, and we were through 12, 13 or 14,000 feet, when clearly things were not as they should be in the navigation section. And it turned Paddy Hamilton, in sharpening his pencil, had cut the flexible oxygen tube, a rubberized flexible tube. He'd done this inadvertently, and of course had been without, we'd got oxygen above 10, we had our masks on all the time, of course, but you have the oxygen going above 10. Paddy had not been receiving this oxygen, and he collapsed. The bomb aimer and the wireless operator came to his assistance, and of course I had to go back down to 10,000 feet or less in order to, we discovered what was wrong, and in order to restore that situation. We hadn't a spare mask, in fact. And as he became conscious again, he started fighting. So the two boys had to hold old Paddy down. This only went on for a minute or two as he was recovering from all this. But we had to abandon, so we didn't go to Frankfurt on the 4th of October for that reason. Happily, in no time at all, he was okay. Now, the 8th of October, we went to Hanover yet again. An unhappy incident right at the end of this flight. It was incident-free as far as I can recall. But I'm committed the sin of sins back at in Yorkshire by landing at the wrong airfield. Not the navigator's fault at all. We brought us in, down the G-line. Airfields, of course, with DREM systems around them, and these DREM systems of light, circles of light around each airfield, they were abutting each other, really. There were so many airfields about. So it was extreme caution and extreme care was called for to ensure that when you were back over your airfield, that you were in fact over the airfield that you should be. And Paddy had carried out his duties, as always, perfectly well, straight down the G-line and over the top, and he said, have you got it? Now, at the airfield itself, of course, was a beacon, a red beacon. I think I was ME, I've forgotten now what it was, but I think it was ME for Melbourne. And I said, yes, I've got it, Paddy, we're okay, thank you very much. And I went round and landed at Brighton. And quite understandably, I wasn't very popular, either with the Melbourne people or with the Brighton people, especially as we'd incurred some damage. And after landing, to add insult to injury, certain damage was discovered in the engines, but one of our main wheels had also been punctured, and of course my aeroplane balked the main runway at Brighton. So that was a very sad experience. Looking back on it, I feel sorry about it. But there you are. It's the sort of thing that I suppose can and did happen, I know, to others as well.
But so these Drem lights were lights to guide planes back to the right airfield?
No, no. The Drem lights was a circle of white lights, circle of lights round each airfield. Melbourne would be here. It would have the Drem system. And then at the approach to the runway, you would have a funnel. So the Drem system would encircle the airfield, so you could always keep it in sight. And then you'd come to the funnel leading you into the runway. And these airfields, you see, Elvington was very near, Pocklington very near, Breeton very near, Snaith, they were all around this area. So it called for extreme care. I'm afraid I didn't exercise that care on that occasion, and it was my fault entirely. Unfortunate, but still. I suppose ultimately I was forgiven. And then that was October the 8th was that trip to Hanover when we landed at Breeton. Followed by November the 4th to Dusseldorf, our seventh trip. Crews were changing, by the way, because people were off sick. And for various reasons, we would have different bomb aimers, different mid-uppers, different tail gunners, the occasion different navigator. And that was only 4 hours 50 on the November the 4th. Then we come to November the 18th, which was to Ludwigshafen. That was our eighth flight. We encountered some problems over the target area and were attacked by Focke-Wulf 190. First thing that happened is, as often happened previously, you get coned by the searchlights. The master searchlight was a purple. It had a more purple hue to it. That was the master one. It seemed to be, as I remember, the one associated with some direction finding. And once that master contacted you, the others would all join up and you would be coned. Now, the practice was, we'd have the colours of the day, we'd be told what they were before leaving Melbourne, red and green or whatever, and we had a series of colours available to us to fire off in the Veery cartridge, Veery pistol. Sometimes we seemed to give the right colours, sometimes didn't matter, and sometimes they clearly didn't work. And this was just such an occasion. And we were very well and truly locked into this cone. The tail gunner, well, I well remember, said corkscrew starboard go. And we had dropped our bombs, by the way. We had actually carried out our run-up, bomb aimer in charge, which carried out all this and dropped our bombs, and then almost immediately this happened. The tail gunner saw this Focke-Wulf 190 at very close range, about 100 yards, crossing from starboard to port,